So as I said in the first lecture, I'm presenting very recent work. And so what you heard on the first day was the second part was completed 2 months ago. What we heard yesterday was done 2 years ago. And this was done this last calendar year. So it's fairly recent. And it has to do with a new method for trying to retrieve phase by convex programming. Okay, so before I get started, I just want to say that this is joint work with Yelena Eldar from the Ternion, Thomas Trummer from UC Davis, and Vlad Voroninsky, who is a graduate student in mathematics at UC Berkeley. And somehow I happen to be his PhD advisor. I'm not sure why. Okay, so the motivation for this work is extremely simple. It's X-ray crystallography. So as everyone knows, X-ray crystallography is a method for determining the atomic structure within a crystal. And the operating principle is fairly simple. What you do is you have a beam of collimated X-rays, which you're going to have strike a crystal. And then these X-rays get diffracted by the crystalline structure. And what you do is you recollect the diffraction pattern on a film or on a photographic plate. Right? So the setup is extremely standard. You have an X-ray tube that produces X-rays. And you collimate these X-rays, they strike onto a crystal, it creates a diffraction pattern, and then you record this diffraction pattern. You record the intensity of the diffraction pattern. We're discussing here a very important area of science in which at least there are 10 Nobel Prizes that have been given in the area of X-ray crystallography, and this list may not be over. Okay, to emphasize the importance of X-ray crystallography in contemporary science, one can consider, of course, one of the major discoveries in the second half of the 20th century, which is, of course, the discovery of the structure of the DNA. And so this discovery was made possible by X-ray photographs. And so what we had is we had X-ray hitting or striking a crystallized DNA structure, and then people were getting a photograph out of this, and it's through this image that Crick and Watson discovered the double helix of the DNA. What the story says a bit less is that they did not actually acquire this data. A wonderful woman by the name of Rosalind Franklin is actually the one who performed all the experiments, and Crick and Watson just looked at her photographs and her experimental results to infer the existence of the double helix. And Rosalind Franklin is a bit of the unsung hero in this story. She died quite young at the age of 37 in 58, 4 years before Crick and Watson and Wilkins were awarded their Nobel Prize. And so she did not get a Nobel Prize for this fundamental discovery, and also, first because she died young, unfortunately, and also because of, according to some scholars, a fair amount of sexism in Cambridge at the time. Okay, so this leads us to the missing phase problem, which is a problem which is very simply stated. What you've got is you've got an X-ray beam striking a crystal, and then you collect the diffraction pattern. And the problem comes from the fact that detectors can only record intensities of diffracted rays, but not the phase. And so you can only make magnitude measurements. And so mathematically speaking, the way you can pose the problem is as follows. You've got a signal of interest, which you're going to assume is two-dimensional, of course. You know, this has extensions to 3D and so on, but in this talk, I will just talk about two-dimensional structures. You have a signal X, which is a function of two variables, T1 and T2. We're going to introduce a Fourier transform of this signal, which is simply, well, as everybody knows, the definition of the Fourier transform, okay, in location omega 1 and omega 2. And so essentially, the laws of optics tell us that the diffraction pattern is essentially the Fourier transform of the object of interest, right? This is the so-called Fraunhofer diffraction limit, which is as you move as the screen is sufficiently many wavelengths away from the crystal, then you essentially see the Fourier transform. Okay, so you would like to measure the entire electric field, X hat, but you cannot. You can only measure its magnitude, but not its phase, or in really what you're measuring is a squared magnitude, the intensity of the field, but you do not measure its field. So when you collect, when you have an X-ray experiment, what happens is that you would like to know the amplitude and the phase of the wave, but you can only measure its intensity, that is, the square root of the amplitude. And so the phase retrieval problem, or the inversion problem, is to recover the signal from a Fourier, a diffraction pattern that is missing the phase. And so the phase retrieval problem, or the inversion problem, is very simply stated, is how can we recover the phase, or equivalently, the signal, given that I can only observe the modulus. Now, to show you how important the phase is, in fact, every physicist knows that the phase of the diffracted wave is the portion that carries the most information, but just to drive this point home, here's a little experiment that I've done. Here you've got the 44th President of the United States, and here we've got the 43rd President of the United States. And for both of these men, I computed their Fourier spectrum, so I calculated the DFT. Okay? And then I kept their moduli, but I swapped the phase. Okay, so this is what I did. I keep the magnitude of Barak, but I'm going to impute the phase of George, and then vice versa. Okay, and so when I reconstruct these images, I get something like this. And so that you can see that really the phase, I hope it convinces you that the phase is what has almost all the information. There's almost nothing in the modulus. Okay. So physicists know that when you're losing the phase, you're in big trouble. Okay. This was not intended as a political joke. Okay. All right, so physicists know that knowledge of the phase is crucial to build an electron density map, and so that it's a crucial step in recovering the molecular structure. And so they try to develop methods to overcome this problem. And so, for example, there's a method due to Carley and Hopman, which was awarded a Nobel Prize in 1985, that makes a lot of assumptions about what is it that you're trying to recover. Okay, so today it's very important because there's more and more activity centered around X-ray crystallography and X-ray diffraction imaging, because we use it more and more, actually. Instead of using it less, we use it more. Okay, so just to give you an idea of what people would like to do, here's the first X-ray photograph ever taken by Röntgen, showing in passing the existence of X-rays. And what you see here is the hand of his wife with a wedding ring right here. What now people will try to do is to try to molecule, to image very fancy stuff using the same principle, X-ray diffraction. And so we've moved from imaging very simple crystals to actually measure or image very complicated things like this. All right, so X-ray diffraction microscopy, for example, is a huge field of activity at the moment. The idea is to use X-rays to image non-crystalline objects by measuring diffraction patterns. We use this to locate the defects and strain field inside nanocrystals. We would like to image disordered materials, biomaterials, nanoparticles, and so on. And I think one of the most exciting areas of applications of X-ray diffraction is the potential for imaging large single protein complexes using extremely intense ultra-short X-ray pulses. Right, so now people are after X-ray imaging to actually image very complicated stuff that looks nothing like a crystal. And so the consequence for us, applied mathematicians or mathematicians, is that phase retrieval is getting more and more important, and also that I can assume less about the signal because I'm after more and more complex stuff. Now here's what people do at the moment. I mean, when I say it's a hot topic, it makes the cover of Nature frequently. What you do is, what you have is you have a protein complexes, which are these things. And what you're going to do is you're going to bombard it with a very short, extremely intense X-ray pulse, where you're going to collect a diffraction pattern just before the molecule explodes. Right, and so you collect one, and so you have a cannon that is shooting these molecules in front of a very short and very intense X-ray beams, and you collect diffraction patterns like this, and your goal is to reconstruct the 3D structure. Okay? And it's a very active area of research at the moment. Okay, so phase retrieval occurs to image the very small, but it also occurs to image the very large. And here is an example in astronomy. In astronomy, astronomers make enormous use of phase retrieval algorithms for the following reason. What you've got is you've got an object which you'd like to image, and so you have an optical system, for example, a telescope, for example, the Hubble telescope or a telescope on Earth, but you're going to have aberration in your optical systems, perhaps because you have atmospheric turbulence in front of it, perhaps because you did not design your telescope very well, and so on and so forth. And so what you're going to collect on the detector is a very blurred image of this thing, because let's say you have a telescope on Earth, just because of the atmospheric turbulence that is perturbing the wavefront. Okay? And one solution to fix this problem is you can think about this as a phase retrieval problem. Maybe I'll try to go very fast about this just to give you a flavor how phase retrieval occurs. What you have in astronomy is that we would like to observe a signal X, but it's again like in lecture number one, it's going to be convolved by a kernel, HJ, which you do not know because it depends on the atmosphere at that time. But perhaps we can assume safely that this process, this stochastic process is stationary, right? So maybe I could try to estimate its power spectrum. And so that's what people do. They're going to say, well, you know, convolution kernel in Fourier space is just multiplication. That's what we've seen in lecture number one. And so perhaps what I could do is I could take several snapshots and then average them. And because the process is stationary, when I look at the power spectrum, everything goes well. And so what you do is you can look at a reference stars. You can learn the power spectrum of the atmosphere because perhaps you have a good model, or because perhaps you point your telescope on a reference star, and so you can actually measure it directly. You can measure the statistics of this blurring field. And so once you have them, well, you're going to make several images. Okay, and so at the end of the day, what you do is you average in Fourier domain your images. And so what this is, it's a true image that you'd like to form times the power spectrum. And of course, all the phase information has been erased, and so what you have to solve is a phase retrieval problem. Okay, so phase retrieval is used to actually image the very small, but also the very large. And it's kind of nice to know that I'm sure everybody knows that when people launched Hubble, it was blind, and it could not see. And the problem is because you had aberration in the optical systems, and people use actually phase retrieval algorithms to correct for these aberrations. Okay, phase retrieval will be heavily used in the next generation of space telescopes, the Jets Wave Telescope, which is trying to build a huge mirror so that you have, following lecture number one, as high of a resolution as possible. But because we cannot make one piece mirror, we're going to have several different pieces that needs to be aligned, and phase retrieval algorithms are used for this purpose. Okay, so it's used in a lot of different fields, in X-ray crystallography, in diffraction imaging, in quantum mechanics, in differential geometry, and so on and so forth. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the phase retrieval problem. Okay, mathematically. So what we think is, we're thinking that we have a signal X, which we're going to think, again, is discrete. And you can certainly transform this theory over the continuum. I don't see a big problem with that. But let's, for simplicity, assume that we have a discrete signal. We're going to have its Fourier transform, which is given by this expression, the usual expression. So we observe the Fourier transform of X. And if I have a perfect system with no noise, what I can record is information about the Fourier transform at locations omega. I cannot measure the phase. I can just measure the modulus, and I'm going to have to sample it some way because I have sensors somewhere. Okay, so of course, if I only observe the modulus of a Fourier transform, there are many ambiguities that I will never resolve, but these ambiguities are not problematic for physicists. For example, I may, of course, if I look at the Fourier transform of an object, even if I shift the object by an amount and I modulate it, then I don't change the modulus of the Fourier transform, obviously. And so I will never be able to recover shifts and phase, global phase modulation. I can also time reverse it, and time reversal does not change the modulus of the Fourier transform. And so I can shift, I can time reverse, and I will not change the modulus. Okay, so if these were the only ambiguities, everything would be fine, but they are not the only ambiguities. And so many other solutions beyond this trivial associate exist, and that's why phase retrieval is fundamentally ill-posed. Okay, so ways overcome these problems have to do with, well, perhaps we would like to measure the face directly, as in holographic techniques, but they're very, very difficult to set up, if not impossible to set up. The most commonly discussed approach in the literature consists in oversampling the Fourier transform to mitigate the effect of not having the face, right? So if I give you the DFT of an object, you know, if you have an n-dimensional object, and I give you the DFT, you have n unknowns which are complex valued, and I give you n Fourier coefficients, but I don't see you the face, obviously you're missing information, right? So people are going to say, instead of sampling the Fourier transform at the Shannon rate, if you will, right? So we have, again, like in lecture number one, we have the spectrum of that we wish to sample, and instead of sampling it at the Shannon rate, like perhaps what you could do is you should sample it at a higher rate, maybe twice as high or four times as high or who knows what. Right, so maybe you would sample it at a higher rate, then you would not see the phase, but because you have more samples than you strictly need, then maybe things are fine. Okay, so that's the approach that is taken in the literature. And so the idea is to sample X, the Fourier transform, on a very dense grid to mitigate non-uniqueness. And so when we can think about this, I mean, the way I think about this is to say that, well, sampling, so you would, you know, we know if we had a compactly supported object, we know from Shannon sampling theory that we can only sample it at a coarse rate. And so all of a sudden, you're going to try to sample it at a higher rate. Okay? And so one we can think about this is by trying to isolate the sample in the spatial domain and take a classical diffraction pattern, which has the same effect. Now, this technique has no benefit for 1D signals, that it does not remove non-uniqueness. And it's okay for multi-D signal. It usually gives uniqueness if we can safely assume that the image is real valued, non-negative, and supported in a known region of space. So for 1D, no benefit. For 2D, under some assumptions, a few benefits. However, this situation that all of a sudden you resolve ambiguities does not say how the signal can be recovered, and so in fact no algorithm guaranteeing a correct recovery exists as far as I can tell, and it does not say whether the recovery is stable, and in fact we'll see simulation in the end that says that oversampling the Fourier transform does not remove ill-posedness at all. Okay. So what is a classical approach to phase retrieval? I mean, if you open this huge literature, you'll essentially see always the same algorithm, which is something that goes roughly like this. Well, what you're going to do is you're going to oversample the Fourier transform, just like what we're doing here. And then the algorithms, what they do is they start with an initial estimate of what the signal is. Then you compute the Fourier transform, and so you get an answer. But then you look at the modulus of what you computed, and it does not match your observation. And so what you do is you enforce frequency, you enforce data constraints by forcing the moduli to be exactly what you measured. Okay? Then now you have an object that matches the data in data space. And so what you do is you invert the Fourier transform. So you get an object, but this object does not obey the spatial constraints. That is, it's positive. It lives in a known region of space, and blah, blah, blah. In fact, it's going to put a lot of stuff. It's going to be complex valued. It's going to leak and put energy outside. So what you do is you enforce the spatial constraints now. Okay, so you enforce the spatial constraints like support, real valuedness, non-negativity, and so on. You get a new estimate, and you keep on looping like this. And hopefully you hope for the best. This algorithm works in some cases, but we did not succeed in making it work. Okay. In fact, it has a behavior which is, well. Here is the problem, which is that one of the set is convex. So for example, this set is nice and convex because saying that a signal is real valued and non-negative, it's a convex constraint. So it has a flavor, this algorithm has a flavor of projection onto convex sets, except that this set is fine, it's convex, this set is not convex, it's actually horribly non-convex, because for those of you who can see it, it's a product of circles. Like when I give you the modulus of a measurement, what I'm telling you is that you're on a circle. I'm telling you, and it's absolutely not a convex set at all. So projecting onto this set is a horrible thing. So what that means in practice, it means that, well, we have this set, when we project onto, is convex. This is fine, but this other one is not. And so we're going to do alternating projections, and so we're going to be stuck here. And so even though an intersection point exists, we will not find it typically. On top of this, so the convergence is problematic. On top of this, you have physical limitation that is not always possible to isolate objects and sample above the Nyquist rate. Sometimes it's possible and sometimes it's not. And so this is a bit problematic. Okay, there are other approaches that are based on ideas from algebraic geometry, because you can see that this is an algebraic geometry problem. Right? I'm giving you algebraic surfaces, and I'm giving you quadratic polynomials, and I'm trying to solve this system of quadratic equations. And these approaches I'm not going to have time to discuss. Okay, I said earlier that phase retrieval occurs in quantum mechanics. This is a famous problem that Pauli asked a long time ago. It's called the Pauli problem, and Pauli asked this very simple question. He said, well, if I know the modulus of a wave, and if I know the modulus of its diffraction pattern, of its Fourier transform, do I know the wave? And the answer is no. Okay, so it's the data of the modulus of a wave and of its Fourier transform is not sufficient to say what x is. And so what people have tried to do is, well, for what kind of classes of signals does this have a positive answer? That's one way of trying to extend the Pauli problem. Another way, which is kind of interesting, is to say, if I see the modulus of x, the modulus of a linear transformation applied to x, in fact, a unitary transformation applied to x, it's not enough. So how many moduli of how many unitary transformations would I need to see before I can actually recover the signal? Okay, so the question, the Pauli conjecture the Pauli problem would be this, is that how many orthonormal unitary transformation do I need so that I can recover x unambiguously from the data of the modulus of u1x, u2x, and so on? Okay, and how would you choose them? And there's a kind of long-standing conjecture in quantum mechanics, which is due to Ron Wright, which says that 3 should be sufficient, but it's completely open still today. Okay. All right, so let's talk about phase retrieval by convex optimization, which is the main theme of this lecture. Okay, so we're going to propose a novel framework for phase retrieval, which relies on two principles. One is we're going to change what we measure, and two is we're going to formulate the phase retrieval problem as a convex optimization problem, even though it does not look like a convex optimization program at all. And we think that the combination of these two is powerful. Okay, the first idea is simple, is to say, well, oversampling the Fourier transform does not seem to be a very viable strategy, as I'll explain at the end. So why would we do something else? What we should do and what we could do, which is easy to do actually, physically, is to do this. He says, I'm going to collect the diffraction pattern of x, but why don't I just modulate x by a waveform w before I collect the diffraction pattern? Right, so x is a signal of interest. W are modulation patterns belonging to a family which is selected by me, the user. And what I could do is I could actually ask to see the diffraction pattern of x modulated by something. In other words, to get different views each time. Okay, so we thought about doing this, and then we opened the literature, and then we realized that, well, this is what some people have proposed doing things like this a long time ago. In fact, Meisel in 1973 proposed to do something along this line. And today, thanks to the work of Rodenburg, it's kind of an active area of optics known as pticography, where people are actually trying to measure several diffraction patterns simultaneously. Now, how could you actually do this in practice? Well, that's very easy. So what I could do is I could have an X-ray source that strikes the samples just like this, and just behind it I put a mask like this, a face plate, which is a mask. And so what you see is that the light is going to go through some pixels, others are going to be masked, and so I'm going to collect essentially the diffraction pattern of this times this. Okay, and then I can change the mask and get several diffraction patterns like this. And so we thought, well, it should be a good idea. It seems to be, based on what we know from optics, it seems to be doable. And sure enough, we opened the literature, and we saw that there were some groups, especially one in Zurich, which is doing this routinely now. Another way to actually modulate the diffraction pattern is even simpler. As you say, typically the illumination beam strikes the sample, and then you collect the diffraction pattern. What if you tilt the illumination beam? If you tilt the illumination beam, of course, you're going to induce a modulation over here, which is exactly what you want to see. So I can tilt the illumination beam to create modulated illuminations. I can put several beams if I want to create any pattern that I want over here. So it's very, very easy by on and off axis illuminations, perhaps multiple illuminations, to actually create structured illumination. Okay, so in fact, we can do this by masking, by using optical gratings, by this technique, which is ptychography, by using oblique illumination. There are many ways of actually implementing this strategy of trying to see slightly different diffraction patterns each time. Okay, all right, so it's a simple thing. Now, if you were to do something like this, what I want to show you is that you're not very far from a solution already, which is a solution which is not satisfactory, but they're laid out there anyway. Suppose I have a signal which is in Cn, so I have n complex unknowns. So I have 2n unknowns, you know, 2n unknown real variables, because for each entry I have a complex, a real and imaginary part. So if x is in Cn, right, we have 2n unknowns, real numbers. Okay, so here we make no structural assumption about x, absolutely none. It can be arbitrary. We don't assume that it's sparse or anything like this. Okay, suppose now I'm going to modulate, I'm going to introduce the modulation operator, which is simply modulating xt by a sinusoid, which is a very simple operation. And now what I'm doing is I'm going to say, well, we're going to collect three diffraction patterns and three patterns only, right? So we're going to collect 3n measurements. So we have 2n unknowns, and we're going to collect 3n real measurements. And the way we do this is we say, well, we're going to do what we used to do. We're going to collect the diffraction pattern, but then we're going to modulate the signal x with 1 plus exponential and then 1 minus I exponential. And so we're going to collect two more diffraction patterns within these functions, which is 1 plus exponential I something, 1 minus I exponential something. And so if you think, if some of you work in optics, it's kind of a something that looks a bit like holography in the sense that you use a modulated version of yourself as a reference beam. Okay. So we make 3n measurements. And what the theorem says is that, well, if you have a signal which is has 2n unknowns, is in Cn, then it is possible to recover the signal from these 3n data points. Okay, and that holds provided that two conditions are true. One, that the Fourier transform of x does not vanish, and second, that the modulation that you use is prime with n. And for those of you who do a bit of algebraic geometry, this is not surprising. That primality enters should not be too surprising. But I'm telling you, this is not the theory I like. I'm just showing you that, you know, we're on the right way. Somehow there's enough information to recover things. Now, we'd say, well, what if the DFT vanishes? Then you cannot apply your theorem. But if the DFT vanishes, well, I can put a random mask, right? I'm going to scramble the phase so that the DFT does not vanish. And the way I can deal with this now is I'm going to say, well, put a mask in front of, just after the thing. This is going to scramble the DFT, and then you will not vanish with probability 1, and so I can recover. Okay, so what we see is that in principle, from 3n measurements, I can actually recover anything I want. So we're not far from this Runge-Weitz conjecture. Okay, so this is kind of the idea of using structured illumination, and now we need an algorithm. And the algorithm is going to be using convex optimization. All right, so let's go through this. I'm going to use an idea which is lifting. And what is our problem? Our problem is that there is a true signal, x0, which is complex valued. I would like to make measurements, linear measurements about this object, but I don't. The measurements I'm taking are quadratic. And so I have to solve these quadratic equations, right? So the measurements I make are going to be quadratic measurements about X naught, which is the true signal I wish to recover. Okay, and so mathematically, and from now on we're going to use this mathematical description, whenever I look at what a sensor is putting, outputting, it outputs the modulus squared of a dot product between X0 and AK, which is a sensing waveform. If we're just doing straight diffraction, it's AK is a sinusoid, and if we use the model I use where we modulate, AK is simply a window times a sinusoid. And so what is the phase retrieval problem? Is solving the feasibility problem where you ask me to find an X that obeys these quadratic equations. It is known to be, in general, NP hard. Solving quadratic equations, in general, is NP hard. Okay, so now we're going to use an idea, which is an idea of lifting, and that might sound strange at first. What we're going to do is we're going to say, let's look at these quadratic equations about X. So we're going to look at the square dot product between AK and X, and we're going to say, well, I'm going to rewrite this as a matrix, as a dot product of a matrices. I'm going to say that this is a trace of X star AK times AK star X, where A star is a adjoint, right? So it transforms a column vector into a row vector and then conjugates. Right, so this is a trivial identity. I'm going to use the fact that the trace is commutative to say that it's the trace of AK AK star times XX star, and I'm going to give name to stuff. I'm just going to say that AK AK star is a rank one matrix that I'm going to call capital AK, and XX star is a matrix, also rank one, which is capital X. And so what my measurements are, they are linear measurements about this matrix. And so what this lifting does, it turns quadratic measurements into linear measurements about XX star. Okay. All right, so now equivalent formulation is this, which says that, well, what does it mean to solve this optimization, this feasibility problem? It means, well, another way of casting is to say, well, you're going to have to find a matrix X, capital X, which is n by n, but it's of the form XX star, so it's positive semi-definite and its rank is 1, and then it obeys these linear measurements. Now, because there is such an X, since X0 is feasible, and, you know, the matrix X0, X0 star is rank 1, it's the same problem as minimizing the rank subject to linear constraints and X positive semi-definite. It's the same problem. I've not done anything. So I'm just looking at the phase retrieval problem with these eyes. Okay, so, all right, so I've done nothing when I just recast the phase retrieval problem as what you've got is you try to find a matrix with rank 1, that is, you try to minimize the rank of X, subject to linear constraints about X, and X is positive semi-definite. Everybody knows that I've not done anything to this problem. It's combinatorially hard. I've not done anything. Now what we do is say, okay, we cannot minimize rank, but we can minimize a good proxy for rank, which is a trace. And so now we're going to look at a semi-definite relaxation of this problem. Well, we're going to minimize trace of X subject to the same constraint. We're going to replace this impossible rank constraint into something which is tractable, it's linear. And so now what we're going to do is we're going to minimize a linear function of X over a slice of the positive semi-definite cone. In fact, for those of you who know semi-definite programming, you're looking at a semi-definite programming in standard form. Right. And that's phase lift. Phase lift is the idea of lifting the phase problem, the phase recovery problem, over the space of matrices, and then finding an appropriate convex relaxation of the rank minimization problem. Okay, so just as a quick primer, do we have people who do not know anything about semi-definite programming? Okay, quite a few. Do we have people who do not know anything about linear programming? You should sue your high school or your college. I'm going to have to talk to Charlie about this, Adrian. Okay, a linear program, everybody knows what this is, except Adrian. We minimize C transpose X subject to where X equals 0 and X is positive, A is non-negative. Okay, so it's a linear program, and the modern way to think about linear programming, I hope I have optimization experts in the room, but the modern way of thinking about linear programming is that you minimize a linear function over a slice of a cone. And what is the cone here is a positive orthon. Right? So linear program is you minimize a linear function over x positive is this cone. Okay, but you're not minimizing over this cone, you're minimizing over a slice of this cone. So something that looks like this, right? So the modern viewpoint about linear programming is minimize the linear function over a slice of a cone. Here, the positive orthon. Now, semi-definite programming is the most natural extension of this, in the sense that all you do is you change the definition of the cone. And so now, what is a semi-definite program is you minimize a linear functional of capital X, which is now a symmetric matrix, or Hermitian, over a slice of the positive semi-definite cone. But it's exactly the same otherwise, it's just you just change the definition of the cone. You had the positive orthon, and now it's a positive semi-definite cone, but everything is the same. You minimize the linear function over a slice of a positive semi-definite cone. And semi-definite programming is a wonderful subject that has experienced tremendous growth in the last 20 years, and now we have lots of solvers for solving SDPs, wonderful theory, lots of good stuff. And we have some experts in the room. For example, Michael Todd has found very good ways of tuning interior point solvers to be very efficient on semi-definite programs. Okay, all right, so we've got our positive SDP relaxations, and now in reality we're going to have to deal with the fact that we have noise, and that's actually very friendly. So in reality, what you do not have is you do not observe A of X naught, you do not observe noiseless quadratic equations. They're going to be noisy. And so what you do is you measure B, which is the data vector, which is distributed about mu, but not exactly, it's not equal to mu. So for example, suppose you're starved, you're photon starved, then you're going to have to pay the photonic noise. In that case, P would be a Poisson distribution with mean mu. So you're going to have a distribution about mu, right? So now you're in a noisy environment where, you know, you have mu, which is, you know, A dot X naught intensity. You cannot measure this thing. You can measure something about it, okay, to get some variability about this thing. And so thinking about this problem as a statistician, what you would do is you would try, well, let's try to find mu and by the same token X, such that I maximize the likelihood. That makes what I've observed maximum. And of course, it's highly intractable because of this horrible equation, mu equals ax. I have to solve quadratic constraints, and that's impossible. So what you do is you just say, well, but you know, now we have our positive SDP relaxation, and so what we're going to do is very simple. We're going to just lift up this into matrix space, and what we're going to do is we're going to just maximize P, or in other words, minimize minus log P. And so we're going to minimize minus log likelihood plus a penalty term, which is enforcing low rank or low trace, which is a proxy for low rank subject to data constraints, right? And so what you're doing now when you go and you develop phase lifts with noisy data is that you have a regularized maximum likelihood estimator but in augmented space. Okay, and that's how you deal with noise very conveniently. Okay, so for example, suppose I had photonic noise. Well, if I have photonic noise, I know, of course, the likelihood of the Poisson distribution. It's given by this. Okay, and so the approach we propose in this case would just be, well, try to find a matrix which is positive semi-definite that minimizes this convex thing. And that's an SDP as well. Okay, and if we have noise, you know, this is becoming quadratic and everything is even more friendly. Okay, so what I'm trying to do here, to say here, is that, you know, of course, we have a principled way of dealing with noise. What we just do is instead of just minimizing the trace, we're minimizing a combination of minus the log likelihood, which is a quality of fit, plus the thing we want to minimize, which is a trace, because we want to enforce low-rank solutions. Okay. Of course, if you give me additional information that the signal is supported in a region of space which is known a priori, so you know I know that the signal is non-zero and only it's in first coordinate. What that means in my matrix world is that the matrix will be non-zero only here, and so I can set to zero everything else. So any additional constraint that you give me carry over to the matrix world, and so that you know I can enforce sparsity over the matrix world, just like what we've seen yesterday with the L1 norm. I can do anything I want. And so what's not only its principle, but it's also very flexible in the sense that if I have additional constraints, I put additional constraints on my optimization program. Okay. So the original phase retrieval problem was about solving these quadratic equations. And with our notations, they are linear equations in XX star. And what we've done is we've converted this to, via lifting, to something which looks like this. And I think the real issue is, have we made things worse? Because, you know, before I had maybe 6 n measurements, 2 n unknowns, quadratic equations, and now I've done something which is unthinkable, which is that now I created an optimization variable which has dimension n squared, but now I still make m equals, I don't know, 10 times n measurement, and now I move into a world which is completely underdetermined. I was overdetermined over here, and now I'm completely underdetermined. So maybe I may have made things much worse. So why did we decide to do this? We decided to do this because of what we discussed yesterday, which is a Netflix prize, which is that what history has shown us is that we could actually recover large dimensional matrices from what appear to be highly underdetermined systems of equations, provided that we have some low rankness. Okay, and so this is the story of the Netflix prize, which we discussed yesterday, which I'm not going to go over again. But basically, the idea that we had when we thought about this lifting was, well, we know that matrix completion is possible. That is, if I see very few entries of a matrix, that is, I have very few linear equations, and if I know that the matrix has low rank, then under some condition, I could actually completely guess this matrix. And so there was we discussed a theorem yesterday that says exactly this, which is I have a low rank matrix. I see very few entries. I would like to find the solution that has minimum rank and is consistent with what I've seen. I want to find the lowest rank fit, but that's not possible. It takes exponential time. So we minimize the nuclear norm instead. When the matrix is positive semi-definite, the nuclear norm is a trace. It's just simply the sum of the eigenvalues. And what I quickly mentioned yesterday is that when I do this, then under Bragg conditions, it will actually recover the unknown matrix, provided it has low rank. And so we thought, well, maybe we're going to be as fortunate as we were for matrix completion. That is, even though we're undersampling like crazy, because the unknown has low rank after all, maybe we're going to be lucky enough so that we're going to recover it. Okay. So this was our motivation. We were completely obsessed with matrix completion at the time, and we thought phase retrieval is a matrix completion problem. In fact, it's a problem of completing a rank 1 matrix. And so maybe things are going to work. Okay. And, you know, there was some theory about matrix completion, which is due to myself and Ben Resch, myself and Terry Tao, where we actually showed that at least in the setup where I see few entries of a large data matrix, completion is indeed possible. But here we have a very different setup because, you know, the measurements we're taking are imposed by the physics. And so we're not sampling the entries of a matrix at all. And also, I don't want to make any assumption, the kind of assumption we made yesterday about the spread of this vector X. Yesterday we needed X is not sparse, and I'm not willing to assume this today. X is whatever it is. Now, I have to say that, of course, for people who are specialists in optimization, this is not a big, well, people have done things like this in optimization. In fact, starting with a seminal work of Shore in 87, people have thought about using semi-definite programming to relax quadratic constraint QPs. I think the first paper on this is due by Shore. People have relaxed very hard quadratically constrained QP, such as the max cut, and at the famous relaxation of Gurmit and Williamson. Relaxations of this kind for quadratically constrained QPs are discussed in the fantastic book of Bental and Mirovsky. In fact, they have a whole chapter on this. We are inspired by matrix completion, but you can be inspired by other things as well. At the same time as our approach, there was this paper by my colleague, George Papanicolaou from Stanford, where they use essentially the same framework to do a different thing, to do array imaging. Okay, so first I'm going to show you some numerical results, which show that this approach seems to work really well. So you see on these plots, you see two curves. You see a blue curve and a green curve. And you see only one curve on each plot. And the reason is because the reconstruction is completely exact. So let me explain what we did here. What we did is we took two signals, which are indicated by these blue curves. And then what we did is we collected four diffraction patterns. These curves have two n unknowns, and we collected four diffraction patterns. So we're in a situation where we have two n unknowns and four n real numbers. Right, so we have two n unknowns and then four n data points. So we oversampled by factor two, if you will. Okay, so maybe we can turn off the light again. Okay, and so when we run phase lift, that we solve this convex optimization program, what we see is we recover the green curve. So we find a rank one matrix, and when we extract, so once I have a rank one matrix, positive semi-definite, well, I can find X up to global phase, right? And when I plot X, it's actually completely superimposed on the truth, and then the same for these random looking signals, which is completely unstructured. Okay, so this really works well. It says that from four diffraction patterns, I can recover the object, no matter what it is. Here it's kind of a low-frequency object. Here is a random object with infinite precision. This also works with three Gaussian masks. And we know we're very close to this conjecture in quantum mechanics. All right, so this is a very boring plot, but it's the most important plot in the talk. What it shows is, of course, you want to be stable vis-a-vis noise. And so what you see here is you see a plot showing you the performance that is a relative mean squared error measured in dB that is on a log scale versus the SNR, which is also measured in dB on a log scale. And what you see is you see that here is like here you're essentially noiseless, and here you're extremely noisy. Like the SNR is low here and it's high here, so it's from lots of noise to noiseless. And what we see is we see a beautiful relationship between the SNR and the mean squared error. Like we have a linear relationship, which is what you would see if you were to solve, I don't know, a well-conditioned least squares problem. And so here we have a problem which is nonlinear. Data is given to us in a nonlinear fashion. The recovery is obviously completely nonlinear, and we might expect the worst when we have noise. But what we see from this very boring plot is that the performance degrades as you would expect if you were to run a well-conditioned least squares problem on linear data. Here, as you see, three different curves corresponding to a different number of illumination or a different number of diffraction patterns. Here you have four, so the mean squared error is a bit higher. Six, of course, it decreases. Eight, it decreases, and because you have more data, obviously. But the point is that when you have noise, and suppose in a noiseless regime, well, you do perfectly well, and when you have noise, well, you have this very smooth degradation. Okay? So this is experiments on real data. Here is an original image which was given to us by Stefano Marchesini, who is an X-ray crystallographer at the Lawrence Berkeley Labs. And so these are gold beads. And what we could do, this is the original image, which is 256 by 256. And this is what we could recover with three diffraction patterns only. And so you see there's not much difference between the two. These were using a different kind of mask, 0-1 masks, like binary masks. Okay, and so not a difference. And then what you see here is a difference between this and this, between this and this. And so what we can see is with very few diffraction patterns and this convex programming approach, we seem to get very consistent and very good results. We played with the SNR as well. Here is, you see an image at high SNR, 60 dB. And so you can see that you get something which is good. And at low SNR, of course, it's not as accurate, but as you can see, it's not crazy either. Okay, so it degrades really smoothly and gracefully with as the noise level increases. Okay, what I was trying to say about Fourier sampling is something like this, which is that we try to use a phase lift to actually deal with just not the kind of measurements our theory wants, but the kind of where you oversample the Fourier transform. And we got into trouble. First, we ran the sign-up algorithm, this kind of alternating projections, and what the problem was with this projection, we could never actually find a point which was either consistent in data space or in real space. It fails to give us a consistent estimate, something that obeys the data I observed and the spatial constraints I know are true. So it will not return this, and so it means that it does not converge to what we want. In phase lift, what's interesting is we can get a consistent point, that is, this is the error on the data space, and so we can get 3 digits of accuracy in data space. The problem is that the relative mean squared error, when we compare the outcome with the truth, it's very far. And so what that's saying is that there are two images that essentially gives you the same data up to 3 digits of accuracy, and yet they're completely different. And that shows that oversampling the Fourier transform is not viable. Okay, so what we believe is, in contrast to what is widely believed, our simulation, and we've made a few, indicate that oversampling by itself is not viable for phase retrieval, even for non-negative real-valued images, because we could get different images that essentially give us the same data. Okay, so now maybe we can turn on the light again. Now I really want to discuss the important part of this lecture, which is, what can I say about this? So just to show you the hardness of phase retrieval, suppose I have a real signal and I take real valued measurements. So when I show you the modulus of A dot X, what I'm not showing you is a sign of the equation. And so when you make one measurement, you don't know. So if you had a linear measurement, you would know that the truth is on a plane. But when I don't show you the sign, you don't know whether you're on this plane or the symmetric plane. And now you make another one, and it's the same ambiguity. You don't know on which side you are. And then you keep on adding the number of measurements. Okay, you see 4, 5, 6, 7. And then what you have is you have this polytope now, and you know that the solution is one under the vertex, but there are exponentially many, and which one is it? And it's impossible to tell. And that's why phase retrieval is so hard. If you were on the complex plane, if everything was complex value, then it's much more difficult, because when you make a measurement, it's not that you don't know whether you're on this plane or on this plane. Now you're on an algebraic surface. And so this is the outcome of 7 measurements. No, how many calls do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 measurements projected onto 3D space. And so, well, after each measurement, I know that I'm on a 3D surface, but now I project it onto 3D, so it's a 2D surface. And so I'm in the intersection of these things, but like, tell me which one and where. I have no idea. Okay. But something is surprising, which is this. We're going to make quadratic measurements, which again are linear measurement about XX star. I'm going to use phase lift. That is, we're going to lift it up in a matrix space, minimize the trace subject to the X equals B, X positive semi-definite. I'm going to use a simple model for measurements. I'm going to say that, I'm going to say that the A's, the equation, the quadratic equation you're going to give me, the orientations are sampled uniformly on the sphere. So the orientations are uniformly sampled on the sphere. Okay. They're uniformly sampled on the complex sphere, is the fx complex value, and real sphere is x's real value. And now the theorem is this. It says that I have an arbitrary signal, then with overwhelming probability, phase lift is exact in both cases. That is, the solution to the optimization problem is exactly XX star, provided that the number of measurements you make is simply slightly bigger than the dimension is n log n. And the probability of failure is very small. So what this is saying is that phase leak will provably recover the signal from quadratic measurements by semi-definite programming, which is a bit surprising in a way that I'm going to explain in a minute. With Xiaodong Li, a grad student of mine, we've been able to push the analysis and show an even more surprising result that, well, if the number of measurements is proportional to the on-degree freedom, then this convex relaxation works all the time with high probability. So why is it strange? Well, it's strange because how is this possible? Suppose that I make measurements about x, right? So I measure ax equals b. Let's say that this measurement implies that I know what is a trace, right? Because in fact, if you take measurements, which is a Fourier transform of x, you will know the trace of x, because the Fourier transform of x, well, what it's going to give you, it's going to give you the norm of, by the Fourier isometry, it's going to give you the energy of x, the two norm of x, and the two norm of x is a trace of x, right? So, but maybe, you know, if you don't follow what I'm just saying, suppose you did not you don't know the trace, I'm going to give it to you. I'm going to say the trace is 1. Then there is nothing to minimize anymore, because I, you know, the measurements imply the trace, and if they did not, I'm just going to tell you what the trace is, because I'm a kind guy. And so all you have to do now is you have to solve this feasibility problem. Just find a matrix which is positive semi-definite and obeys these many equations. But how can it have a unique solution? Because, well, what is this x positive semi-definite? Well, it's a huge body. You know, how many degrees of freedom does it have? Well, it has n squared degrees of freedom. So it's a very huge body. You know, it's almost the entire space. It's full. I mean, if you take x to be positive semi-definite and you say, let's move around, you know, it's full. I mean, it's okay. So it's a big body. How many equations do I give you? So you have n squared, you know, this is a cone of dimension n squared. How many equations do I give you? Well, I give you on the order of n. And what you're telling me, if I look at the result, if I believe this result, you say, what you're telling me is that there's only a single point which obeys these little n equations and is positive semi-definite. That's what the theorem says, because it says that the only point is xx star. I mean, how can it be? Because I've got this huge body, I have very few equations, so I'm going to take the intersection between this huge body and a very high dimensional plane, and it certainly cannot be one point. But what the theorem says is, yes, it is, and it is only one point. And why is that so? Well, it's so because the point you're looking for has low rank. And so because the point you're looking for at low rank, it's an extremal point of this convex body. And so when I look at this positive semi-definite cone, a slice of the positive semi-definite cone, you know, slice where the trace is 1, and I have my solution here, which is xx star, and I look at how does the point that this cone looks like, it does not look like this fat thing. It actually looks something like this. There are very few directions starting from this point that will maintain, that will keep me in the positive semi-definite cone, and many that will not. And so now you say I have very few equations, now I have a space of huge codimension, but because this cone is extremely sharp around rank 1 matrices, what happens is that the intersection is exactly what you want, because then it becomes tangent to this extremely sharp cone. And that's what the theorem says. The theorem says that, you know, what your intuition tells you is not true, that actually, even though this cone has huge dimension, even though you're intersecting a cone with huge dimension, with an affine state of huge dimension, the intersection is actually a single point. Okay. And this is surprising. In fact, I talk to people who are specialists in semi-algebraic geometry, and when I talk to them, they say, your theorem cannot be true because of this. In fact, it is true. And it is true because we have a point which is a very extreme point on the positive semi-definite cone. Okay. On top of this, you can try to answer questions that have to do with stability. And so in real life, What you do not have is you cannot observe this, but you observe this plus noise. And so what you say is that you minimize the trace subject to, now you're going to relax the constraints in a usual way, and you're going to solve this optimization program, and then I'm not guaranteed to get you a rank one solution. And so if you do not get rank one solution, I'm going to extract the best rank one approximation to my solution. I'm going to perform principal component analysis. I'm going to extract the best rank one solution, and that's going to be my guess. Okay? And what the stability result says is that, well, this works well in the sense that when you solve the SDP relaxation, you get a matrix X hat, which is in the Frobenius norm, very close to what you're looking for. How far? Well, it's within the noise level. And because this matrix is close to XX star, you have a perturbation argument in numerical linear algebra or in linear algebra that shows that if a matrix is close from another one, their leading eigenvectors need also to be close. And so from that, you can deduce that what the algorithm produces, which is a leading eigenvector of this, is close to the leading eigenvector of this, which is the truth to within accuracy epsilon over the norm of X. Okay, so what this says is that if you have no measurement error, then you have exact recovery, and if you have small measurement error, then you have small recovery error. And what this theory does, it predicts, I don't know stuff like this, and what it does, it predicts a kind of curves. The theory predicts exactly this kind of curves that we see empirically that we get when we decreases the signal-to-noise ratio from no noise to lots of noise. Because now you have a theorem, and then you plot the curve that this theorem predicts, and then you get this kind of curve that we see, which explains why the method degrades gracefully as the noise level increases. Okay, it predicts it for Poisson noise, it predicts it for Gaussian noise, it predicts it for lots of different noise structure, and so we can account for this theoretically. All right, maybe I would like to stop and to conclude by saying that what we have is a principled approach to phase retrieval, which makes no assumption about the signal whatsoever. It handles noise fairly gracefully. When we play with the software on real data, we get good empirical performance. And I think, if I can conclude these lectures, to me this is unreasonable that it works so well, that it points to the unreasonable, Wigner very famously mentioned the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. I don't know enough of mathematics to know what he meant, really. But what I know is I know I've played enough with convex programs. I know enough of convex programming to tell you that it's unreasonably effective. I can prove that things are wonderful. Does it mean I understand it? Not sure. But it's unreasonably effective, that's for sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for these lectures that also seem wonderful, even if we didn't completely understand all the details. Are there any questions?
Yeah, 0.87, something like that, right. But here we got that the approximation is exact. I mean, it's so, yes. I mean, it's like there's no error. It's in a world of max cut, it's saying that you find the max cut.
Another pun, you can look at that picture and say you have sharp sound.
Yes. Right. And the reason you have stability, to comment on Mike's comment, is to say, when you have stability, this plane gets tilted and maybe it becomes a slab. But because this thing is still very sharp, what you're going to do is you're going to try to find something in this cone, something which is in a slab. And so when you have noise, like you have some uncertainty about the altitude of this slab, so to speak. And so you're going to look for a solution which is between two slabs, because you know here you have your noise level. But because you're looking at this very sharp thing, what you say is, you are here, but because you're very sharp, you cannot go very far. You can go at most here or here, and that's why you have stability. It's because this angle is almost orthogonal that it's actually extremely stable. But, you know, this is very, these are words, right? I mean, saying that the angle is orthogonal, you're going to have to establish it at some point. And that's where all the heavy mathematics is. A very heavy mathematics.
Yossi?
Yes. So what Laferre works is, you know, it's trying to, I mean, just to kind of rephrase the question, the work of Laferre has to do with minimizing, I don't know, a polynomial, just in the simplest form. And so we know that minimizing a polynomial is NP hard. And so the work of Laferre does something like this. It says, It's a semi-definite programming relaxation, but of a very different kind. So what Laferre does, he says, well, minimizing P of X is equivalent to minimizing T subject to PX is less than T. Okay, so now you have decision variables T and X. And then what it says then is that this polynomial, PX minus T, it's, you know, this is equivalent to px minus t non-negative, or negative, or something like this. So t minus px non-negative, sorry. And here what Laferre uses with Pablo Perillo is essentially the fact that if I have a non-negative polynomial, if a polynomial is a sum of squares, then it's non-negative. And so I'm going to replace this constraint, which is not tractable, saying that a polynomial is non-negative, by saying that a polynomial is a sum of squares. And so, yes, and sum of squares relaxations are FDP relaxations, but as you can see, they're quite different from this. We're much closer to Max Cut than to the work of Laferre.
And the other thing you can say is the applications you've been talking about basically say the unreasonable effectiveness of convex programming when you can choose your constraints.
Well, but here the constraints, they are like when you can, not your constraint, when you can choose your structure. When the object has some structure, be it sparsity or, yes. Constraints mean the way you design the measurements. Here the measurements are really like, Yes. It's exactly this, is the unreasonable effectiveness under structural assumptions. Absolutely. And the fact that there seem to be very little gap between what combinatorial optimization can do under structure and what convex optimization can do under structure. The gap is extremely narrow. And that I don't understand why it's so. I mean, I can draw pictures like this, I can even prove theorems, but the fact that at the end of the day, no matter what you do, it works. That's just it's like the central limit theorem. I can prove the central limit 17 different ways, I think. But do I really understand it? Not so sure.
One thing, you can retrieve k from the magnitude, and then get, for example, you show that based on the more information, is it not under the
degree? Excuse me?
So we have the example with Bush and Obama, where they have more information, operating between k from the magnitude from the algorithm.
Right.
Well,
I mean, it's not, because what I do is I have to see several diffraction patterns to be able to do this. And so by looking at several diffraction patterns, I can disentangle the face, so to speak. Retrieving magnitude from phase is it's a good problem. I think it's easier, but, you know, I've not thought about this. Because really the problems that physicists work with, you know, there's this huge area which is now called lensless imaging, where you don't need lenses to make images. But when you do lensless imaging, you lose phase. And to make it work, you need phase retrieval algorithms. That's the area I'm familiar with. I know less about the other one, where you measure phase but not magnitude. Magnitude is fairly easy to interpolate. I mean, it's just phase is like it oscillates so quickly. If I see the phase here and here, I have no idea what's in the middle. Magnitude is very different. I prefer to talk about this offline, if it's okay.
Other questions?
Okay, I'll make a confession. I think in the last few years we've seen two wonderful stories. One is that sparsity is everywhere, and if I'm missing data or if his data is corrupted, it doesn't seem to matter. I can recover information from undersampled by L1. And we've seen another story that says that, well, for matrices, the exact same story is true, that if I have low-rank matrices, and if data is missing and corrupted, it doesn't matter, and I can recover it by nuclear norm minimization. I would like to have a third story, and I don't know what it is yet. I don't know. I mean, it seems that we've explored the two important things, sparsity, low-rankness. Then we need to find another structural assumption which people really care about, and find an efficient convex proxy for it. And I don't know what it could be yet.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank Professor Kangas again for this series of lectures that I think has really been among the highlights of our activities here at the Fields Institute during the year. And I'm also very happy that people from so many different areas have come to these lectures. And so I would like to mention a few of the things coming up in our current program on inverse problems in imaging that might be of interest to quite a few of you. So we're at the beginning of an intensive month now on variational methods and compressed sensing. In July, we have a summer school on mathematics of medical imaging, followed in the latter part of August by an industrial problem-solving workshop on medical imaging. I think that the activities in these events might be of interest to quite a few people here. A different problem, but on somewhat related themes, is a month-long program on mathematical neurosciences starting in the middle of May. So we do hope to see many of you again at activities here in the near future. And as a small token of our appreciation, we have a little gift for Professor Kangas that we usually present to our distinguished lecturers at the Fields Institute here.
Okay.
And we very much hope that you'll wear this when you visit the Simon Foundation.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.